Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
But it was just this past weekend that the news broke that Broadcom was said to be in talks to buy VMware. Well, it became official this morning.
Dina Bass is Seattle Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. Dina joins us now on the phone from Seattle. We got some more details thanks to you and to Leanna Baker, Dina. $61 billion. It's a record tech deal. There's a go shop provision here. What else does our investor audience need to know?
Broadcom is basically saying that VMware is going to become the new name for its software business. It's going to become the focus of a software business that they've been building for the last couple of years. There is also a go shop provision in here, though. So VMware can, for a limited period of time, try to find other bidders. So we'll see if that creates additional late-breaking drama in this deal.
Boy, it's good to be VMware, right, I guess, at this point? I mean, who else wants it or who should want VMware, Dina?
You know, VMware has partnerships with all of the major cloud companies. So, and the closest one is with Amazon's cloud business. So we're talking Amazon, Microsoft, Google. The problem is that in the current regulatory environment, it's going to be difficult for any of those companies to put together a deal potentially. That's going to be a little hard with the scrutiny that regulators are putting on large tech. Intel, another chip maker, obviously, Intel's CEO used to be the CEO of VMware. Cisco is another name that's been mentioned. But we don't know what's going to happen from here on out.
All right. So we have a very smart audience. I know that. But if they're not familiar with Broadcom and VMware, what is it about these companies? What do they do? And what is it about them that maybe makes a good combination?
Well, you have to look back at Broadcom's M&A strategy over the past couple of years. They're a hardware company, a chip maker, but in order to reduce their exposure to the cyclicality of the chip industry, they've been buying up software companies. They bought a big part of Symantec. They bought CA Technologies. And part of what they do when they do that is almost a private equity-like strategy. They look at these companies that are a little bit more mature but have solid, successful product lines that they can continue running and bring in money and wring costs out of at the same time. Software tends to be a more regular flow of revenue than hardware and chips in particular, which are, as I mentioned, very cyclical. So when you look at VMware, you have a company that pioneered a type of software called virtualization software. And even though that technology is being surpassed by the sorts of things people are using more frequently in the cloud, they still have a very strong position. They're still very deeply embedded in a very large number of corporate networks. Their software basically helps you reduce the number of servers that you have to use and cut costs.
Well, I think about where we were yesterday, Informatica in Vegas, right? And this was, yes, cloud, but it was also about taking data, making it intelligent, doing lots of different things with it. Like it's just this, I feel like there's a lot of crossover happening within the tech industry.
Right, with so much data
it's
out
not
there.
Just the cloud,
question is, how do you make it valuable to different customers? So Dina, what does Broadcom end up doing with VMware now? Why are these companies better off together than they would be by themselves?
Well, VMware has been in a tough spot for the last couple of years. There's been a lot of financial engineering going on around the company. So if you go back historically, VMware was a very successful startup, was bought by EMC, and probably the most valuable tech deal in the history in terms of what EMC paid for it and what it ended up making them in money. But then EMC gets bought by Dell. VMware has been, spun off from Dell, back into, there's been a lot of back and forth about what's going on with them. And while that's going on, they've been trying to come up with a strategy to deal with this legacy product line that I talked about before, this virtualization software. How do they modernize? How do they regain the leadership role they once had in a market that's bypassed them? And so they've been investing in a lot of different areas, like security, mobile device management, networking, but still the vast majority of their revenue is coming from this older software. So they've been struggling to figure out what the strategy is as a standalone company in terms of how they're going to continue growing. Their revenue growth has ticked down into the single digits, where 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it was in the double digits. So that's been challenging. Being owned by Broadcom frees them from having to worry about that. Broadcom, I spoke to Broadcom software president Tom Krause this morning, and he said, look, yes, they're a single-digit revenue business, but that's the type of business we run very well. And so VMware gets to be, outside of the stock market scrutiny of around its growth rates, and Broadcom will try again to squeeze costs out of it and focus on profit of this aging product line.
Hey, Dina, what's going on just more broadly in the tech industry, especially as we've seen kind of the big tech really under fire, if you look at certainly the performance in the equity markets this year so far, but there's been a lot of tech deals, right, and some big ones this year.
Sure. Obviously, there's Microsoft Activision at $69 billion. You said earlier, this one's the biggest tech deal, but that's only if you consider Microsoft Activision a gaming or entertainment deal, I suppose. What we're seeing right now is kind of a confluence of different potentially conflicting factors. So companies' valuations are going down because the market is going down. So acquiring a company becomes potentially cheaper. That said, the company doing the acquisition, if they are doing it by stock, well, their stock is going down too. So you have to weigh that. And we talked at the top of this conversation about the increasingly difficult regulatory environment around large deals. So you have a couple of different forces pulling on things, but valuations are going down, and that may enable some more opportunistic buying for those buyers that can get their deals approved by regulators and have the cash or the stock to do it.
Kind of fascinating just to see what's going on in what is, so far, I feel like a very crazy financial market year. Dina explained so much. Thank you so much. Dina Bass, she's Seattle Bureau Chief at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from Seattle. So again, right, we heard about the deal just not even a week ago, and here you have it.
Yeah, but in just a few minutes, we're going to talk about today's big take, which is about, the troubles brewing in tech.
Yeah, exactly. This will get you thinking in a big way. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So more Americans died of drug overdoses in 2021 than any previous year. Tim mentioned these numbers. More than 100,000 Americans, that's up 15% from the previous year. More than 80,000 died using opioids. And just yesterday, we got word that Teva will pay $110 million to settle opioid-related claims. That's just in West Virginia. And remember, earlier this year, Tim, there was news that four of the largest U.S. corporations have agreed to pay roughly $26 billion to settle a tsunami of lawsuits linked to claims that their business practices help fuel the deadly opioid crisis.
Well, we've got an expert voice with us to talk all things when it comes to the opioid epidemic here in the United States. Dr. Caleb Alexander is professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Alexander is, we should note, has been an expert for plaintiffs in opioid litigation. Dr. Alexander, how are you?
Fine. Thanks for having me.
Well, you've been working on something. You've been developing the Opioid Industry Document Archive. It's launched by Johns Hopkins University and UCSF. We should note that Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, it is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. What is the Opioid Industry Document Archive?
The archive is an effort to shine the bright light of day on millions of documents that have been generated through ongoing opioid litigation. It provides an opportunity for members of the public, bereaved who have lost a loved one, researchers, historians, legal scholars, and others to be able to examine the corporate practices that has contributed to the worst drug epidemic in our country's history.
You know, what's fascinating to me, Dr. Alexander, and I think about this when any of the drug companies seem to come to a settlement to settle those opioid-related claims, they usually say, well, we did nothing wrong. When you look at this archive and you are able to see these documents, is that not fair of them to say that?
Well, it's an excellent question, and I should start by saying that it's unusual that out of litigation we get this opportunity to actually put these sorts of documents in the public domain. All too often, unfortunately, these documents remain sealed, and the public never has an opportunity to actually see these types of internal corporate communications, emails, presentations, sales reports, budgets, and the like. And, you know, I don't think we would be seeing settlements of billions and billions of dollars. You just pointed out the one for $26 billion with four of the country's largest corporations. I don't think we would be seeing settlements of that magnitude if there wasn't wrongdoing that had taken place.
Dr. Alexander, we are getting, you know, thanks to the Opioid Industry Document Archive, to some really great work by journalists who've dug into this over the last few years. We are getting a good understanding of what some companies have done with regards to their marketing of these pharmaceuticals. The cat, though, is out of the bag, and the proof is in the pudding. As Carol mentioned, more than 100,000 overdose deaths here in the United States just last year. What now does the United States do? What can we do to start preventing these deaths and to get these numbers to come down?
Well, there are many abatement activities that are underway in cities and counties around the country. And we know, for example, that there are highly safe, highly effective FDA-approved treatments for opioid addiction. And we need to scale these up massively. But the real focus of the archives is really to allow for us to learn what took place within these corporations so as to prevent these sorts of activities from occurring again. And we have a precedent, which is tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
The opioid archive sits upon a prior archive of tobacco industry documents that's been used for decades to reveal industry strategies, to question science, cast doubt about the health harms of its products, and delay public health regulation. And using those documents, there have been very important policies put in place regarding tobacco, such as state and local ordinances mandating smoke-free public spaces and workplaces.
Well, we certainly could talk for a long time on this, and hopefully we can talk again in the future because we've unfortunately run out of time. But interesting and important work that you guys are doing. And as you said, it's not often that people have access, public access to all of the documents involved in cases like this. Dr. Caleb Alexander, he's professor of epidemiology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, joining us on the phone from Baltimore. Of course, the school is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. And Dr. Alexander, as we said, served as an expert for plaintiffs in opioid litigation.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers.
Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts Gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the cover of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, it's also today's Bloomberg Big Take. It's how the tech route isn't just cyclical. It is well-earned and it is overdue.
The story by Brad Stone and Lizette Chapman, it's this week's cover story, as Carol mentioned, is available on newsstands on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. With us now to tell us all about it is Jeff Muskus, senior features editor for Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, along with Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, who's with us as well. Joel, so all good things must come to an end, and it's certainly seeming like that's happening in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, we kind of called the bottom, and now it's coming out. You know, NASDAQ 2 days, it's creeping back out since we kind of put the finishing touches
all right,
on
Joel Weber said it. It's official.
There we go. it'll all regress tomorrow, I'm sure. Basically, you know, we do a tech issue every year, and what we really wanted to talk about here, and I think it just became impeccably fortunate timing, because it's like the world caught up to the ideas that we had in this package. Is everything has started to change. The VC backed funny money, when money was free, led to a lot of exorbitant in ideas and investments and SPACs and crypto, and we're seeing a regression to the norm, I think. And what Jeff really set out to do, and as the architect of this package, and Brad Stone and Lizette, like you mentioned, wrote the cover story, which I think is the today's big take, which really sets the table. But there's a lot of other things in this package that help kind of amplify this idea. So Jeff, being the guiding hand that put all of these stories together, like what were you setting out to accomplish?
Sure. Well, like you said, Joel, we sort of started out from the position of, okay, well, you know, here we are sort of returning to varying degrees of a new version of normal as people return to their offices and that sort of thing. And so for the first time, really, in 2 years, we're taking a sustained and marginally less COVID-inflicted look at where is the tech industry now? Where are all these, you know, big name companies that, you know, many of us haven't been looking that squarely at for the past couple years? And what does the tech world look like now, and where is it going? And with that in mind, you know, a lot of our best writers and reporters here at Bloomberg News and on the tech team took a look at some of our biggest boldface name targets, from Instagram and TikTok to Google and all the way down. And then, you know, sort of looking forward to where's the tech world going, we have a bunch of interesting looks, both at things like prediction markets that are sort of on the bubble of regulation, and biotech stories like this look at what are called Better Odds Babies, the science of polygenic risk scoring that might well just be the next big thing.
So one of the things that I loved about the package was, like, there's serious stuff, but then there's, like, the perfect encapsulation of everything that Jeff's talking about. Remember the scooter craze?
Oh, yeah. Bird, Lime, and
Yeah, start to feel a little bit like a Segway now. It survived the pandemic mostly, Jeff, but why was it such a perfect story to include in this context?
Well, like you were saying a minute ago, Joel, right before the pandemic, the bottom started to drop out of this wave of basically decade-long cash burning as a means of not just survival, but as the main strategy for a huge part of the venture-backed tech industry. And so the scooter craze was well-suited for that moment, where the whole deal was, okay, well, you know, this or that mega fund is going to give you guys nine-figure checks on the regular to go out and build an explicit monopoly. Now go do it. And coming out of the pandemic for a variety of reasons, or, you know, as people start to need things like scooters again, we come back to find these companies sort of clinging to life to varying degrees and without the easy access to capital that everybody got used to.
Hey, Jeff, I feel like one of the things that I feel like with every guest, and you often hear, like, pets.com, like, are we likening...
Webvan.
Exactly. Like, are we likening... like this tech route that we're seeing, is it similar to what we saw in 1999, 2000? I mean, are those comparisons fair, or is it different?
I think we're still a ways off the sort of industry-wide carnage that we saw at the end of the dot-com bubble, but Brad and Lizette are smart to draw the comparison, at least in terms of the hype machine, between the sort of infamous Pets.com
Super Bowl commercials.
Ads and the Super Bowl ads we saw this year with all those crypto celebrities.
Yeah, the crypto pets comparison.
My favorite was the Larry David one, because I'm just a big Larry David fan.
I don't know. There are some other ones that are pretty good, too.
Pretty.
Nice. So, what does VC actually have to say about this? Because that figures into Brad and Lizette's story, to bring it back to today's big take, right? Like, because they're undaunted, really, right?
Yeah, for what it's worth, most of the sort of mainline VC types that you'd want to talk to and that Brad and Lizette went out to for this kind of piece, kind of said, well, the next thing is coming. Like, this is going to expose the businesses that aren't ready for the next moment for what they are, and the people who have done the work to prepare for a storm like this are going to be just fine.
Well, and more new money keeps coming in, right?
Well, I mean, there's been,
right.
So, yeah. Like, we talk about all these startup companies that are able to stay private for, 10 years,
and,
right? And they don't have to tap the public
and
markets.
Just yesterday, Carol Andreessen Horowitz announced a record $4.5 billion fund for crypto.
Yeah.
Just for crypto.
Top?
it could have been a long time in the process.
Or chasing the next big thing and trying to figure out where it kind of goes from here.
And so I think, just again, to bring it back to Brad Stone and why we wanted to do this on the cover, it was there is a controlled burn every once in a while that hits, and that's kind of what it feels like right now, where it's let's suppress some of the funny money, let's go back to basics. And while that's happening, and I think we talked about this yesterday with Sarah Fryer on the show, it's even the Metas of the world have to look themselves in the mirror and realize that, TikTok is eating their lunch, and they have to basically take their business model and basically come up with a way of fighting back. Right. And even Meta has to deal with this stuff. Right. The biggest companies in the world. So tech's obviously ever changing. It's why it makes it so much fun to talk about. But even the sacred cows, there comes a moment that everything is cyclical.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable, right? It's the big tech that are having to kind of do some soul searching.
That's right. Whereas, the last couple of times we sort of talked about something like this, as Brad and Lizette point out in the piece, it was something that the rest of the industry could more or less look at or call out as an outlier, a Theranos or even a WeWork. The damage here, as you were saying a moment ago, is too broad-based to just sort of ignore as the cost of doing business.
Great timing.
We just do it every week.
I told you, I want that Joel Weber crystal ball.
Remember, Joel called the bottom.
Yeah.
All right.
Remember this day. Remember, no pressure. Joel Weber, he's the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, and Jeff Muskus is senior features editor at Bloomberg Business Week, both in studio. This is The Cover Story, now on newsstands, online, and on the Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive. You drive,
you crazy. It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we are just about 10 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. It is time to drive to the close, and we've got a good guest who's going to give us some specific names that he's interested in.
Max Wasserman is the founder and a senior portfolio manager at Miramar Capital. Max, joining us this afternoon on the phone from Northbrook, Illinois. Max, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Well, before we get to some of the picks that you have, I just want to get your take on the markets and what we're seeing right now. 2 days in a row of gains for the indices. Are we out of the woods?
I don't think necessarily we're out of the woods, but I think we're trying to find a bottom.
Okay.
And with the Federal Reserve released some notes the other day and basically didn't surprise anyone on the downside, meaning they're not giving any shockers. So that helped. And also, I think with some of the retail numbers that came out, Dollar General, Dollar Store, basically coming out and saying that the consumer's not dead, with an oversold market, I think you're getting some life.
So you think you think it's oversold?
I think the market's a little oversold right now. The negativity is so pervasive that when you have any negative news come out and the market starts to rally, that's usually a good sign that we're trying to find a bottom. And I think we're in the seventh inning If you would, baseball analogy of a
so much can happen that's in those final innings, though.
I mean, that sounds
entertaining.
But, I mean, Max, you sound really optimistic.
Well, I think when you know what the problem is, that's a big step in the right direction. Where before, the Federal Reserve didn't have a clue where the problem was. They thought, you know, inflation was transitory. They felt that they could take a lackadaisical approach on raising interest rates. Supply chains, all these issues we really know about. It's just addressing them and working through it. So I think, yeah, I'm optimistic in the long term. It doesn't mean, like Harold mentioned, you could get it more downside, and we could see another 5 to 7% on the downside. But we think we're through the majority of the problem. I mean, it's been a bad market. I mean, the NASDAQ was down 30%, and the S&P was close to down 20%. It could still go further, but we're not bailing on this market at this point.
I'm just going to another sports. I'm talking about football. Have you ever seen Tom Brady pull out a game in the last quarter or the last few minutes? I mean, it's pretty remarkable.
Oh, yeah.
So much can happen in so many different ways. Volume is something, and I can't remember whether it was Randy Watts or another guest who brought in, that what we tend to see, though, is not the volume conviction behind an up day. It's not there. And I'm looking at one of the metrics on the Bloomberg in terms of volume on the New York Stock Exchange, and it looks like we're down again. So that there's not necessarily, even though it's a broad-based rally, it's not like a lot of investors are jumping in on this.
No, I don't think they are. In fact, when you come into a holiday weekend, you're going to have even less volume activity. But I think what you're starting to see, though, is you're trying to find the retailers, find a bottom. I mean, whether you take a Target, a Walmart, or even a Costco, you're trying to find out where the bottom is. And you're starting to see that. You can still go lower. I mean, we all know emotions can take you. We know the Fed could surprise at some point and raise interest rates 75 to 100 basis points where somebody's not expecting it. That being said, to be super negative at this particular juncture, I'm not sure it serves the purpose, because we know the interest rates are going up. We know inflation's here. We know we have supply constraints, but they're being addressed. I think we just have to work through this excess in the market, and I think we're doing that.
Okay, let's talk about some of the individual stock picks that you have, because you got some really interesting ones. I want to start with UPS. Why are you bullish on UPS?
I think we're dividend growth. We like a lot of companies that are paying above average dividend, growing it, good multiples. So UPS has been able to make a return on capital of about 30%, and they've been really able to profit in the last mile of delivery. You take that along with the fact that trailing earnings are about 14 times, forward earnings about 15 times right now, paying a 3.4% dividend. They increased the dividend 49% in the past year, and they increased the buyback by up to $2 billion in stock. So it has all the fundamentals. We think it's in the right place. And when people are shopping, they're still using UPS.
Max. Fundamentals, sure. Though. Is it really fundamentals when we're talking about buybacks and dividend growth versus maybe investing in the business or hiring more? You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
I hear what you're saying. And what's interesting is we've had a lot of guests coming on who are looking at stocks that are paying dividends. And to me, that is a little bit more of a safer play, that you know you're going to get that dividend no matter what the share price does and no matter what the environment does.
Well, you know, we've been a consistent dividend grower. It's not like lately we've been doing
it. No,
so
I know.
The firm has been. But look at the fact that they were able to raise the dividend 49%.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big thing. That's a cash flow. They have a new CEO, and she's been able to really focus on profitability. So they're handling they've increased prices by about 10%. So they're being able to handle some of the inflation. That doesn't mean there's not problems in the fundamentals facing the whole industry. But again, we're looking long-term on these stocks. And when I look at the risk-reward of a stock of this caliber, paying the dividend the way they did, increasing it, having a return on capital of about 30%, I don't mind holding a company like this when it's below market multiple and paying such a strong dividend. So, yes, it's going to be a while, but these are the type of companies, when the economy gets better, they really benefit. And it has some defensive capabilities in the fact that it's trading below the market, and it's giving you a lot more in yield. So we like that part. And they're very profitable. So to us, it's a tough market, but this is the type of company we want to hold out in.
Okay, what about VF Corp? This is a company that makes the North Face, Vans, Timberland, Supreme. Why are you optimistic on VF Corp?
Well, we're optimistic more now. I mean, the stock was about $85 on a 12-month basis. Now it's down to like in the mid-40s, right? It's 48 today. It's up 3. It's paying you about a 4.2% dividend. It's a dividend aristocrat. And their business has been growing very strong. It's just in China where they've been having some weakness in the Vans line. if you look at it from their perspective, they've been able to get rid of the inventory at pretty much 90% of full price, which is really good. And the gross margins they just reported, they only had to decrease in the operating margin by like 50 basis points. So here's another company that's trading at 13 times earnings. It's in the apparel outdoor wear, which is a $500 billion industry. They own 2% of it, like $11 billion in revenue. And we think they have the potential as everybody starts to travel and they go out and they spend more. So the fact is we're recommending the stock. It's been already hammered from the 80s down.
Right.
So we think the risk-reward at this price, again here, is asymmetrical. We think we could see a lot more upside as the economy and people start traveling and buying. We know they have problems, but
right.
they just came out and reiterated the cash flow, and they just reiterated the earnings. So at this time at 48,
yep.
downside, we think it's there.
All right, got to run. Hey, Max, thank you so much. Max Wasserman, he's founder and senior portfolio manager at the independent private registered investment advisory firm Miramar Capital, joining us on the phone from Northbrook, Illinois.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.